We continue with the history of GDR film, talking about the seminal movie Der geteilte Himmel, The Divided Heaven, based on the novel with the same name by Christa Wolf. Here she is again. By the way, she received the National Award, Nationalpreis, for this movie. And first of all, here we have Konrad Wolf again. Just to get back to some information, some details which I forgot yesterday on Christa Wolf, because you might have read here or there about her. Although she is the leading representative, one can say, of GDR literature and very well acknowledged. She is a controversial figure nevertheless. She had a little bit the same kind of problems which in recent months Milan Kundera had with the Czech public. That is, she has a very early in her teens, actually, when she was about 20 years old, episode of collaboration with the East German State Security Service, who, however, turned her down as being a very ineffective informant, because she didn't denounce actually someone, but she had this kind of relationship for 3 years and was heavily criticized on that after 1990. This just as a little remark on Christa Wolf. Let's turn to Konrad Wolf. And talk about Der geteilte Himmel, the divided heaven. I told you already, Konrad Wolf was a very respected, already at the time when he did this movie, artist, belonging to a, one can say, influential family. Also, one of the things I didn't mention yesterday is that he had a very powerful brother. This gentleman, Markus Wolf. Markus Wolf was the vice minister of the Ministry of Security in the GDR for a long time. So you would have a very odd couple of brothers, the one being one of the most outstanding artists of the country and a rather critical spirit. Markus Wolf. Wolf being, one can say, the top spy of the German Democratic Republic. He was leading the section for foreign espionage of the GDR. So he had not so much to do with domestic affairs, spying on GDR citizens, but basically spying on the Western world. And he survived his brother by some 15 years. And so here we see him on trial after 1990 in a trial for different crimes connected to this espionage business, which he did not have to serve a term in prison, but was had got a verdict on probation, I think. Interestingly enough, he was also considered to be an eventual follower of Erich Honecker if the GDR would go in a more reformist communist way, such as the Soviet Union, if the GDR would have gone in the direction of Glasnost and Perestroika. A lot of people considered Markus Wolf would have taken the lead, but that's pure speculation. Just this as a to complete the picture of this of Konrad Wolf, of his position in GDR society, so speak. And now let's turn to the movie. You have seen the movie yesterday, and I had finished yesterday with asking you, making up your mind about eventual question or comments, impression, which you might want to share about the film. First of all, did you like it? Did you found it interesting, worthwhile looking at, or just purely remote, far away? Some comments or views on that?
I think camera work was very interesting.
Interesting.
Camera work.
Camera work, yeah. On what aspects would you... give an example, which part of the camera?
Initial shoots, shots.
Sorry?
The very first shots were very, very interesting.
Yeah, the very first, which is the one where the trams move through the city, or which one do you mean?
When the heroine fell.
Yeah, the breakdown of the heroine from under, I don't know, from a lower angle, or I'm not familiar with all the English terminology. So camera work, very interesting. Let's say, if you, or in particular, if you try to imagine in which time this was done, what kind of expectation usual viewers would have if they expect a love drama, which it is after all, not exactly the thing which everyone would expect. Other things which might occur to you as unusual, or as one might also comment on the things which were not so unusual as to the content, or what else? Have you seen similar films? Or did it remind you of other films, which of the time or later on? What do you think is the political message of the film? How would you judge it? You see, it's a film shown in 64 that I have told you yesterday a little bit about the political history of the GDR at the time. We had 61, the construction of the Berlin Wall. What do you think what the political statement of the film is? Perhaps you have an opinion? No? Do you think it's rather critical or rather affirmative of the Berlin Wall? Rather supporting the Berlin Wall as such, or kind of criticizing it, being against it? Where would you position the film?
I think the film supports the idea of war.
Yeah?
Because it shows that the Western world is bad.
Is bad.
It will dehumiliate the people.
Mm-hmm.
When you move to West, you won't be such human.
Yeah. So this is to which episode are you referring? To which?
The very ending.
The very ending, when we have the
when the heroine goes to visit her boyfriend.
Yeah. Yeah, this is at the very close. When were there other, so to speak, episodes where the West was occurring? Because only in the very end of the film, action is actually taking place in the West when they go to this restaurant and so on. But there were to what extent is the West already there in the movie before that episode? Do you remember? Where the West, or let's say Western people, or people being having the attributes of the West, are part of the action of the story. What about the family of the male protagonist, of Manfred? What kind of family is that? Would you characterize it? So, were they just ordinary, average GDR citizens, model citizens, citizens of the worker and peasant state? Or what social class, social features would you say were the parents of Manfred, of the male protagonist, representing? They were representing, of course, the old society, the leftovers from capitalist society. It was a bourgeois house, and their manners at the table when dinner was they had dinner were, so to speak, very accurate, so to speak, in a very conventional way. And this might not have got through evident and clear due to the subtitling. The mother of Manfred sometimes listens to radio. And what she listens to, of course, is West German or West Berlin radio, sending messages to support the spirit, the anti-communist spirit of East German citizens. So this is clearly the Western world inside the East German territory, so to speak. It's a class enemy inside society. And Manfred comes from there, and to a sense, this is mentioned also once, in the end, goes back. So there is seemingly a very clear position, and obviously also one conforming both to the spirit of the novel and of Konrad Wolf's own interpretation of the novel. One can say that the novel and the scenario converge very neatly because, after all, Christa Wolf herself cooperated together with Konrad Wolf and her own husband, Gerhard Wolf, to write this script for the film. So one cannot say that there is a something like a difference or in tension or so between the novel and the actual film. This is different from the film we will see next time, where you have a larger distance between the actual novel and the film, which was derived from it. So let's go little bit deeper into the details, in some details of this film. One can say that Der geteilte Himmel is standing in a among a numbers of films where Konrad Wolf combines two issues when he deals with the GDR as a background of his story. One thing is that he deals with problems of the concrete socialist reality of his time by putting women into the center. The women always stand sort of for society as a whole. This is, for instance, as I mentioned yesterday, the case with this film Solo Sunny, which was one of his last ones from 1979. With Der geteilte Himmel. And then there is a second, so to speak, number of films when he deals with the GDR, a second theme in these films, that's dealing with the relation between intellectuals and as individuals and society and power structures. This is evident in, for instance, in 1974, The Naked Man on the Sports Ground. It's about a sculptor doing a sculpture, which then arouses a scandal. Or also, in Genesung, Recovery, you have that theme. And of course, in the big biopic on Goya, which is also about the relation between the artist and society, but set in a different context. In Der geteilte Himmel, the problem of the title itself, Der geteilte Himmel, is standing metaphorically for the problems of construction with socialism. But, and this is interestingly enough in contrast to a lot of other films of the time who try to deal with such themes, from a very subjective point of view. In the center of the story is a young woman recovering from a crisis after the breakup of a love relation, of a love affair. And at several points in the film, it is stated that for itself, this love affair is a rather banal and normal story. It's nothing particular. It's just a love story going wrong, and in the end, the woman is falling sick and has to recover from it, and from her sickbed, she has these sort of flashbacks in which these the whole drama is told. To put this into context and to combine it with a reflection on how socialist society and how should be constructed and what decisions have to be taken is a rather bold step in comparison with other films at the time, which are handling this in a rather propagandistic or outspoken and very much more simplistic way. It's a move away from an, so to speak, objectivistic imagery to depict the path to socialism. There is here the prominence of the vision or the angle of concrete individual conflicts, but set in a very large, one can say literally, cosmic context by relating it to heaven. You cannot think of something larger and bigger, so to speak, than heaven, as you all know. However, this view on heaven and putting it into perspective of the heaven, of heaven is not impregnated by a kind of, so to speak, optimistic, far-reaching, star-reaching mood and perspective, but it has a certain pessimistic, skeptical undertone. It's, so to speak, not imbued and filled up with realistic, with ritual optimism, which you could associate if you refer something like construction of socialism to the sky and the star and the universe on the whole. This story shows the making, presents the making of socialist society as depending on individuals' decision, who have to take their orientations from concrete life, such as a love drama, and who do not derive their orientation and their ways how they come to join the socialist project from party dogma, from the party dogma on the course of history, who says this has to come that way because there is no alternative to it. Nevertheless, the movie makes the claim, the story makes the claim that the action of individuals in history have a, so to speak, universal relevance. Everyone takes part in this universal drama which construction of socialism entails. So this is a film about constructing socialism, but without, so to speak, clichés of model characters, as it would have been required in very conventional versions of socialist realism. Of course, although there is this critical undertone against such dogmatic versions of socialist realism, it is in the end, and that has already been stated, a politically, so to speak, correct statement in the context of its time. Correct in so far as in the end it supports the status quo of the years of the 60s, that is the fact that the wall has been built, and that was already evident from the novel itself and became evident by the film as well. So to speak, this is part of this notion and of this view, which I already mentioned yesterday, that for a lot of intellectuals, and in this regard both Wolf Christa and Konrad represent their generation of younger intellectuals and artists in the GDR. They represent this mood and this expectation that after the construction of the wall, which was not greeted as a big victory, nevertheless there would be a second chance for building up socialism in a more humane and so to speak, acceptable way. On the other hand, one should not forget that this plot by and in itself stands in a certain, so to speak, number of films which already had used the metaphor, so to speak, of a love couple in order to tell the story of dividing Germany. But whereas in the other films these stories would inevitably end with a happy end, on the good side, so to speak, where one of the partners would join the other couple in the East, and thereby love can be fulfilled and socialism be constructed. Here we have another one, in a way more realistic approach, and so far as it shows that this German division nevertheless left a deep trauma, a deep wound, also in the feelings and in the mentality of Germans. Normally, if in the whole overall German context of films dealing with German division, having a negative end, a disruptive end, if such a love couple was divided between East and West, was rather the tendency with West German films. West German films would be much more pessimistic in their outcome and would show how bad and how evil the division, the wall, and the communist system is, by showing that it disrupts personal relationships. So this was kind of a conventional plot which you would see more often in Western, West German or American films, whereas on the Eastern part, if it was told in a very conventional way, you would the story would try to come to an end with a happy ending. Konrad Wolf and Der geteilte Himmel kind of opens up that dichotomy, or this cliché dichotomy. Now, at the same time, this story about the construction of socialism is a story, of course, about social transformation in East Germany. It's a woman of a lower class origin which aspires to higher education. Originally, at the beginning, we see that she sits in an office in the secretariat of the school. She then is allowed to visit as being prepared for becoming a teacher. And so she gets access to higher education, and she thereby also gets involved into social relations of another kind, because university students also on the side have to take part in industrial production, joining work production, work collectives in their semester vacations, becoming part of such work collectives. And so she has a double world she lives in this whole movie. And this is also a way to negotiate, of course, a relation between these two works in this movie. We have two instances, so to speak, two worlds, two spaces in which the socialist project is represented. On the one hand, we have the teacher seminar itself with the professor, who stands for the claim of the rationality of the party, of the historical mission of the socialist project as it is represented by its intellectual elite, and who is presented here as a rather sympathetic figure, because it's also against dull and opportunistic dogmatism, as you see in the classroom controversy about the flight of the parents of one of the classmates of Rita. On the other hand, the other space is the work collective in the railway car factory, which stands for the experience, the attitude, the mentalities of the actual working class, which is very variegated and not monolithic, because you find different types of colleagues being part of this collectives. But this collective has a very important function in so far as in the end it is this collective which brings Rita, if one wants so, back into life, into socialism, via this older figure, Metanagel, so to speak, ordinary worker who is not represented as a, in that sense, as a model hero, but as someone who is very honestly and sincerely fighting for the improvement of work, and who had the bad luck to be punished for a cheating procedure in earlier times when he was a master of his working group and therefore had been degraded. And he says, I have a, and he introduces himself as a kind of fallen hero who has a, I don't know how it was put in the subtitle, who's on a down slope or way of career development, so a receding career development. And he's struggling for putting things right again to bring the working collective he's part of again on the good track to improve its efficiency. It is very interesting to see that in this film, the one of the central dramas of socialist work collectives, of production and socialist enterprises is dealt with at length. That is the question how to raise the rates for production, to what extent this can be done on a voluntary basis, to which extent workers by negotiating the terms of payment try and actually did cheat the management in order to get higher wages without working more. This is something which was a constant issue in socialist economy, and it is rendered here in a very rather accurate and precise way. Also regarding the harsh conflict this always aroused inside the working collectives in the GDR. On its own, this, to show this per se, is not exceptional. It occurs rather often in GDR movies, and it was also tolerated and wished by the party as long as it did not attack the party itself as an institution. You could criticize a single party functionary, but of course not the party per se. Rita, being taking part in both of these worlds, the part of ideological education and higher aspiration for becoming a teacher, and in this collective of workers in the railway car factory, makes, so to speak, a process of maturation. It's insofar this story a classical itinerary of individual maturation, of growing individual, growing as an individual by a sequel of conflicts, which climax then in a trauma connected to her, so to speak, private life. But this climaxing, so to speak, is always intertwined with dramas going on at these places. You have two conflicts going on and on, protracted conflicts. The one in the classroom about her solidarity with this girlfriend, with this friend of hers whose parent has had left to the West, and the conflict inside the work collective around the organization of payment and whether one should, is allowed to cheat on the management or not. What is, by entangling these individual stories, these different level of conflicts with the love drama and its traumatic experience, we find an exceptional plot for this time in dealing with German division and so far, and this sets Der geteilte Himmel apart from other films in the time dealing with the effects of the war. What is exceptional is to represent the traumatic impact on East German society of the construction of the wall, of this event as such. Thereby, the novel and the film refrain from any attempt to attribute to the construction of the wall and of the German division the aura or the nimbus of a successful strike against the fascist forces in West Germany, or how the very stereotyped language would have it. It is not the construction of the wall, the division of Germany, is not something which has to be glorified or celebrated as a victory, which was the ideological, so to speak, blueprint of the party as it was when it announced the construction of the wall and when it tried to legitimize it in its campaign, after August 61. Thus, the spectator is left with a notion, with a feeling of survival, of a dramatic transition. A dramatic transition which opened new space, new chances, new possibilities, but nevertheless a survival which cannot be, a process of survival which cannot be looked back upon as if it was a victory, something positive to remember. The division, the construction of the war remains a loss. It, so to speak, nearly cost the protagonist's life. And it is not at all clear at the moment when the film ends whether this story will go on in a positive way, because she's still recovering and there's no, so to speak, safe future secured. It's an open situation with which the film ends. Now, so far for the plot of the story, the way in which the division of the wall and the division of Germany and the construction of the wall is introduced, and so to speak, which validity it gets here. But it would be, of course, a bit short-sighted, and one would leave it at that, as far as the specificities of Der geteilte Himmel is concerned. Der geteilte Himmel is also breaking away from conventions of narrating in obvious, at the same time, in the context of its times, provocative ways. First of all, if one looks at the plot, the emplotment itself, the story is framed by the breakdown of Rita and told in 7 flashback episodes. So it is told as an individual reconstruction of what had happened in the eyes of this female main protagonist, which is nevertheless commented on of voice by a female narrator. And this, of course, puts into question the very position of a unified auctorial, so to speak, omniscient narrator. It rejects by this very several divergent levels of narrating claims of objectivity and, so to speak, also ideological leadership. It puts the emphasis on the notion that this new reality, in favor of which the female protagonist makes her choice, is not wholesale and organic, but fragmented and contradictory from the beginning. And the aesthetic way to represent this fragmentation, this risk and this proclivity of fragmentation of the world the protagonists are facing, including the world of socialism, the understanding of which Rita is trying to get at, this extremely polysemic, this extremely fragmentation of reality is rendered and always represented again and again by the very polysemic usage of the metaphor of the divided sky. The sky shows up visually in a lot of instances, and division also shows up in a lot of instances, so to speak, processes, structures of separation. This starts right away with one of the first shots in the city of Halle, where the action is set, where the love couple lives, as we have it here. And still see this very nicely if you go to Halle, or also here, the streets leaving open a fragment of the sky, in this case a very ordinary shot from one of the main streets in Halle, but this is just the beginning of the movie. The framing of the narratives, where obviously flashbacks end and begin again, is always rendered by a big highway bridge arching over the place in the countryside, in the valley where Rita recovers at her parents' place. Sorry, not this one. Oh, where is it? Here. This is shown in varieties of variations. Sometimes she's also working on the bridge, but always framing, so to speak, the longer flashbacks into the story itself. This is also accompanied several ways by this alley of poplar trees where she comes from. That's, so to speak, always leading back into her old place or coming from her old place. And the first words of the movie, when she's still in the city, we have the comment from the off voice, the female narrator, who says, and there the motif of the sky and its problematic quality is shown very evidently. The first words say, I quote, "The city breathed more heavily than usually that summer. Its breath puffed smoke from hundreds of smokestacks into the clear sky. The sky struck us suddenly as incongruous and hard to take. The air weighed heavy upon us." So the sky is not something which liberates, but it's something which is rather oppressing, is imposing. It puts structure and ambivalent feelings and stress actually on it. It's like describing when air gets too heavy in hot summer. And this refers also to the fact that this was since decades already then, and still is, an area within a large in vicinity of a large chemistry plant where you have rather heavy problems with air pollution. This region was known for its very bad air already in this time. So living there was considered as living not in an open free sky, but in a very tough, densely habitated industrial region. And this oppressive structuring view of the sky, which has an imposing effect, is reaffirmed at the end of the film when the couple breaks up and engages in the following dialogue. Rita: "Lovers parting ways used to look for a star where their gazes could meet at night. What should we look for?" She's asking him. And Manfred answers, "At least they can't divide the heavens." And then Rita answers, "Oh no, the heavens are the first to be divided." That's, so to speak, her balance of the whole experience. The heavens are the first to be divided. They are not the last resort of freedom and open space, so to speak, where one can do whatever one wants or project into whatever one wants. On the contrary, they are the first thing which will fall apart. The title of the film, Der geteilte Himmel, is thereby not to be seen just as a description of a grim and realist statement about history as it had to be confronted by individuals. It has to be added that, and there is a certain ambivalence in the German word teilen. The German word geteilt contains a double meaning. It's not just divided, but at the same time, it signifies also shared in a very ambivalent way. You can, so to speak, share something, and you use the same word in German as if you divide something, teilen. And so the skies which are evoked here at the same time instances, spaces which are separating, divided, but they also connect by being two spheres which are close to each other, by belonging together originally. And this ambivalence, of course, is always evoked if one speaks of something like a geteilter Himmel. It can go in both directions, although in the end we have a split up of the relationship and also of Germany here. The principle of separating and connecting individuals and the individual and the collective is followed very consequently throughout the film, also in its visual representation. It's used as visual markers to set scansions in the narrative, to go from one episode to, or sequence of to another. One recurrent motif which you might remember is the setting the couple, so to speak, the space of the couple against the outer world, and if they want to relate to the outer world, they have to look through this roof window in their apartment at the top floor of the parents of the house of Manfred's parents, and this motif is used several ways to show their situation as against to the outer world. And there then is also as a way to use used as a scansion between different episodes and sequences, a spatial ordering which shows up several times in a sequence of shots, more or less like a little ritual in the film. It's this part of the city which the protagonist Manfred introduces as his old school way. And they have to climb up that little street here, then walk over a bridge, and it is always shown with a shot into the sky. And when they have transgressed this bridge, they end up at a view on the river. This is always a kind of moment of not relaxation, but of still stand where the protagonists are given the possibility to reflect. Of course, the metaphorical meaning of this picture of the river is also rather evident, I would say. It also shows a process of continuous structuration. The sky, the view in the sky is structured, always fragmented, even either by grids or by rows of trees. It's not just there. And here we have a process of structuration which also has something, so to speak, alluding to some notion of timelessness. A river and where the water comes from on the left side, it's a quiet surface, very homogeneous, not structured, very even. There the water comes from, then it goes down this precipitation, this little waterfall, and then it starts being structured, stirring up whirls and foams and mingling different forces, and so to speak, you have a sort of physical interaction. And this is what the protagonist there in this moment can look at and reflect upon, and which is of course part of their own destiny, that things do not look and are not like they would seem at this, on the left half of the picture, lean and even and homogeneous, but if things get into action, if things get to be changed, they want to got to be diversified. There will be interaction, there will be steam, heat, and so to speak, a conflict, and in an uneven and not predictable way. That the unlimitedness and openness, which is usually associated with the notion of the sky as the access to the university. So this association, which is a bit the conventional expectation if one speaks of the universe, of the cosmos, of the open sky, this is chosen by Wolf very consciously. He tries to provoke this association in the spectators. And this is evident by the little episode when the space travel is included in the story. In the little story of the test ride with the new railway wagon, this test ride is interspersed with footage from the rocket launch of a Soviet airship. Yuri Gagarin, there we see the little part, this is from footage from Soviet television or Soviet film. We see a little part of the rocket climbing up, and then very characteristically we see these collapsing perspectives by looking out of the window when the rocket climbs up. And then Wolf has also inserted photos, stills from the control center activities, people following on the Earth the signals of this launch of a rocket of Yuri Gagarin in April 61. So just four months before the wall came. And this is commented by words in original sound in Russian from the off. And these words are Yuri Gagarin's words out of space, where him about his feeling as a peasant's son marching, so to speak, through the sky like through a field. And these Russian words are then repeated by the off voice of the narrator, I quote. So this is Yuri Gagarin translated by the narrator. Quote, I see the clouds and their light shadows on the distant yet beloved planet Earth. And for one moment the farmer's son awoke in me. The perfectly black skies looked like a freshly plowed field and the stars were the seed corn. End of quote. And it is to this reaffirmation of seeing even the sky like a part of a natural resource which you can work on like a field in your surrounding on Earth, which humans can, so to speak, freely dispose of and structure by their means. It is to this notion that the narrator then comments, commenting her own experience. Quote, everything that happened began to make sense. A farmer's son plows the heavens and scatters the stars as seed corn over them. Will our little bit of human warmth be able to withstand the coldness of the cosmos? ? So there she parallels this metaphorical vision of Yuri Gagarin, takes it back into her own vision of structuration, and asks herself whether this attempt to structure the sky will prevail, whether humanity warmth will prevail in this under this process. In view of the temporal placing of this episode, the month immediately preceding the construction of the wall, this of course amounts then to an acceptance of what would happen and what happened, the separation of the couple taking place and being reaffirmed by the construction as a wall, as a way not only to divide heaven but to construct it, and thereby to construct the future of society, of socialism in Germany in this particular case, but also of humankind in generally. And the principle of divided space is also then reprojected into the very, so to speak, banal setting of individual relations among people, that space has to be structured in order to move forward. There's one nice picture which shows this at the end of the story, and there we have two parallel shots always alternating, where you can see the different perspectives of where structuration might lead to. You have this final scene where in the final episode where Manfred and Rita meet in a restaurant. And here we have a decentration because it's a little bit more to the west. And the east is getting a little bit larger than the west, I would say. Yeah, because I was wondering why it's not symmetrically put in the center. And it's not a move of the camera, so it's just like that and remains like that for the whole episode of the whole shot of this lunch scene. So they sit in a restaurant already, so to speak, neatly divided up west-east-wise, as we have it from our visual convention, that on the left side you would have the west, on the right side you would have the east, and separated from outer space by these blinds. This is a way to separate from the outer space, which doesn't have any perspective any longer, in contrast to the very playful thin grid on this top on this roof window on in the apartment. This represents sort of a dead-end situation, which is then, however, contrasted by the continuous alternated cut in between dialogue of Rita, where she talks with her professor about what had happened. She tells him the story and then and so on. Also, this room is divided, as you see, by this large corridor in the middle, and they sit on different sides of this division. And there is quite a distance between them. You can say it's the distance between the male power holders of the party state and the one holding truth, so to speak, instructing truth, and the female representative of society. But indifferent to the other picture, there is a three-dimensional, this picture gives a view to the third dimension, because in to the rear things are progressing, they are climbing up. And as you know, in such cases, the parallels in the end and will approach each other. They will never meet, but they at least they approach each other. And this whole division, so to speak, evokes a notion of progression, of moving on. It's not a kind of a dead-end situation. So also down to these details, how communication is set and in which kind of setting it is put, structuration of space, one can say the structuration of the space is projected down also into such minor or small scale details. On the whole, this made this movie, and this is only the section of, I'm speaking here now only about this visual staging, so to speak, of the principle of structuring space and structuring room as an active, so to speak, engagement of humans with something which conventionally is considered as to be open-ended, the cosmos, the space. And at the time, of course, you had a lot of talk and also ideas about human the universe as such, that it would be an guarantee for freedom and so to speak, endless possibilities and so on. Here we have another vision of the sky and the space, which rather shows that this is something which has to be which has to be apprehended by fragmentation, by drawing limits, by otherwise people cannot get there. This is so to speak the dire consequence of this notion. On the whole, such aspects, such means of representing this, together with this very unconventional and fragmented way of narration, this made a very complex study of the relation between the individual and the emerging socialist project as it presented itself to the authors after the construction of the Berlin Wall. It, so to speak, says clearly, after the construction of the Berlin Wall, we are in a very complicated, difficult situation. In a comparison to a lot of other works with the theme, the time after the Berlin Wall, it is very blunt and, so to speak, unforgiving. And so far, it leaves no doubt that the construction of the wall meant a deep, traumatic experience for the East German society, that it was received as an act of unilateral violence, which had to be survived, first of all, from which society had to recover, and on which society had to reflect, to which society had to find its own understanding, and which was not the understanding as it was officially proposed. The wall is an act of, is a victory, the wall is an anti-fascist border against intrusion from outside. It is evident that, as the story is put here in this movie, that the wall is about preventing people from going west, and that it is necessary in order to find a new approach in construction of socialism that the heaven has to be divided up. Its complex visual structure, and in particular then the non-linearity of the narrative structure, the restraint from conventions of diegetic logics, the centrality of the subjective experience-oriented view on the course of events and their interpretation. These are elements in the aesthetics of the film and in its content, thanks to which the divided heaven is often regarded as an East German representative, or if not the East German representative, of the Nouvelle Vague, New Wave generation. This has been, among others, substantiated by a comparison which is very often drawn of Divided Heaven with Alain René's classic Hiroshima Mon Amour. Hiroshima Mon Amour, the film of 1959, after a novel by Marguerite Duras. And actually, this is not only a parallel which was done as an observation by observers, film critics, etc., but it has been then also confirmed by Konrad Wolf himself. Of course, there are several evident parallels: the centrality of the female subject narrator, the totally, so to speak, totally banal, by itself, banal love story as the dramatic carrier of a critical engagement with traumatic historical experience, the technique, the narrating technique of flashbacks and elliptive narrative structures, also much more in René's than in Wolf, the integration of documentary footage. And so far, the Divided Heaven can serve as confirming the notion that East German cinema at this time, in the early 60s, was taking part in international film trends, that the filmmakers were following the work of new generations East and West and looked out for their way to react to it, that they were considered themselves also as a part of the international community of the new generation of the Nouvelle Vague. Probably Konrad Wolf's film stands out in this direction as the most visible, in the most visible way. But one should not forget about this, that this Konrad Wolf's film, Der geteilte Himmel, was only part of a whole generation of films which can be seen in this international context of a new wave. Although I would support also the notion that from an aesthetic point of view, probably Konrad Wolf was the most consequential proponent of such a development in the GDR. Other filmmakers, on the whole, stuck much more to conventional ways of narrating, which doesn't make them less interesting, but I think Der geteilte Himmel is standing out in this regard. Both, finish on Der geteilte Himmel, one has to say that both, and this is interestingly enough also for the atmosphere, for the cultural atmosphere in the GDR at that time, both the novel and the film were quite successful with the audience. It was not regarded, this film was not regarded as a too remote, too artificial, too difficult to understand movie. It was a widely acclaimed success, ranking among the top five or so in the year when it came out in East Germany, and as had been the novel as well. And this is also important to see that the East German audience as such was at that time still at least rather receptive to such new trends in cinema and would take the opportunity to see them. By the way, also if Nouvelle Vague films from other countries, from France or in particular also from the other social countries were shown in the GDR. Now, the question is, what comes after Der geteilte Himmel? Are there any questions left to Der geteilte Himmel? Because I will now switch over to some other films and so leave the geteilte Himmel, the divided heaven, behind. Any comments or insecurities or difficulties of following, understanding what I'm saying? Okay. Yeah. Now we come, so to speak, to the last phase of the time period I'm covering in this second double lecture, which are the middle and the late 60s. I yesterday already mentioned the so-called 11th plenary of the Central Committee in 1965, the plenary which brought a turnaround again in cultural policies, restricting the liberty and the creativity of, in particular, film artists, but also of writers and of musicians. And one of the big scandals or scandalized phenomena of art production were the films which had been produced in that year, 1965. You have to know that top functionaries were always knowing what was going on, what would be the next big films which DEFA would bring out. So they were quite cognizant of what the next interesting film, next provocative films would look like, also if the wider public did not yet know them. From the stage on when the final cutting was to be done, top party functionaries could share in previews and develop their opinion about films and also have the possibility to intervene. And one among them who did so was Walter Ulbricht himself. At times, even Walter Ulbricht would, if there were very contested issues, allow whether there can be a scene of with naked people or not. And he would say no in most cases. So it was very sometimes very imminent intervention. And so there was one movie who gave a name to a whole series of movies, which were all banned in consequence of this 11th plenum, plenary of the Communist Party. The movie was called Das Kaninchen bin ich, The Rabbit Am I, or the, I am the rabbit. This is why these films were then called Kaninchenfilme, rabbit films, because they were all put into one group and Ulbricht was referring to them as these very provocative Kaninchenfilme. Das Kaninchen bin ich is a film on a woman who has a love relation with a judge, and the judge happens to be the one sitting on trial against her brother for attempt to fly the Republic. So we have again the problem of the wall divided Germany being part of social reality, and the dilemmata and the conflicts which come out of this, which deal very much with the system of jurisdiction and of juridical policy in the GDR after the construction in 1961, was very critical and very outspoken and very, one could say, politically incorrect. The film was done by Kurt Metzig, who was one of the founders of the DEFA in 1945, who had also done the huge Thälmann film I mentioned 2 weeks ago. Stylistically, Metzig was always more on the conventional side, conventional narrative cinema. With, however, at times very provocative scripts, which he would realize also in full faith. It was not that he was an opportunist when he would do a Thälmann film instead of such a film. He was also trying or sharing this view that one should improve socialism as best as one can, and also therefore realize such critical scripts as the story about this woman getting into trouble with the juridical system. Another one of these Kaninchenfilme is the one I mentioned already 2 weeks ago, one of the Berlin series, Berlin um die Ecke, Berlin around the corner, Gerhard Klein, Wolfgang Kohlhase, on rock and roll youngsters in 1965. The reason why this was more or less unacceptable, meanwhile, while Berlin Ecke Schönhauser was still had been received with some support, was that in this film now, Wolfgang Kohlhaas and Gerhard Klein show the social life of youth 5 years after the construction of the wall as being as it is, without any direct interference of the West. It seems to be authentic GDR homegrown youth culture, which they show. And this, of course, was unacceptable if the youth did not look as the party functionaries wanted to have them look. Then a next movie of quite some importance, which I think merits the second place, or so to speak, on par a place with Der geteilte Himmel as far as the quality of a Nouvelle Vague film is concerned. Jahrgang 45, born in 1945 by Jürgen Böttcher, is a study of the everyday life and of the quite dull and boring everyday life of a young worker in downtown Berlin, who has goes through a divorce with his young wife and therefore takes leave from work for several days, but does not know what to do with this. And so he shows up at his workplace again. You see a East German society which is relatively stagnant, which is boring, which is not at all dynamic and constructing socialism from morning to evening. On the contrary, and this is set in a vision of East Berlin, which is still relatively strongly marked by the remnants of the Second World War. You still have some ruins here and there from air raids, and in particular with a lot of unreconstructed old housing from the turn of the century, where workers still live as they did more or less 60 or even 100 years ago. And this was shown in a very detailed fashion, in a way which the party functionaries did not like, because they would not like to see workers being presented that way in this very, so to speak, old-fashioned, pre-socialist way. And at the same time, in a way which is commented on in a very matter-of-fact way, not as such as something being scandalous, which has to be removed by, let's say, the initiative of well-minding spirits from the party or so. The party is far off. It does not have to do much with the life of this young worker. And so this was in its very sober and also very impressive visions, camera work of the cityscape of East Berlin. It was provocative in several ways. It was provocative, for instance, also by the way that it showed that East Berlin is part of a divided city without showing the wall, which was quite tricky because the wall could never be shown in any movie. You could not have a view on the wall from the eastern side. This was forbidden by definition, but Böttcher instead showed West German tourists driving with a bus through the street, climbing off, going somewhere, coming back, and it is evident these West German tourists in their West German bus are only there because there is the wall and because they are doing this kind of tours where they see the inner part of the parts of East Berlin, and which is the after effect of the Berlin Wall situation. And only this part of the scenery aroused a lot of criticism because it was considered as being very pessimistic and, so to speak, kind of damaging the spirit which was required to make East Berlin a socialist capital. one can put, or in, let's say, in film history, Jürgen Brückner's movie, born in 1945, is most often mentioned as being an example of the potential of East German cinema going the Nouvelle Vague way of connecting to this international trend, which, however, by the consequences of the 11th plenum, of the 11th plenary, was disrupted. And one can say that Jürgen Böttcher was the one who was hit most severely. He, from that time on, never was allowed to do a feature film again. He had to go to the documentary section of the DEFA, respectively the television, the East German television, and could, so to speak, not stand out as a gifted filmmaker. He made a double career in so far as he was also a painter, but as a painter also he met quite a lot of problems and forbidden expositions and so on. So he was really, for him, this 1965 event was really the break in his career as an artist. The next movie to mention in this context is the last one of the forbidden one. On the whole, one speaks of 12 Kaninchenfilme. I'm just giving you a short sample of them. And they're also, you can say, rather banal and not so much sensational or critical or qualitatively good films among them. But the last one, which I mention here, Spur der Steine, Traces of Stones, is probably the most important one. Why is it the most important one? Well, in the end, it was forbidden in 1966. Today, after it has been re-shown immediately in fall 1989, 20 years ago, more or less precisely, it's the best known popular DEFA film which has survived so far, Spur der Steine. It features the star of East German cinema, Manfred Krug. He is playing the role of a worker, a leader of a brigade on a construction site. And this is one of the very famous opening shots of the opening scene of this movie. It takes place on a huge construction site where an energy plant is going to be built, and this is a brigade of joiners who concrete workers. And they are led by Manfred Krug here in the middle. This is, of course, is quoting the Glorious Seven, the opening scene. It was a very evident and, so to speak, explicit allusion to this kind of bravery and sort of mocking this kind of heroism which these workers aspire to. This gang, so to speak, or this brigade, somehow is dominating and ruling over the construction place, and they also use illegal or not quite legal means in order to secure their own earnings by kidnapping cars with concrete and sand if they need it in order to fulfill their plan. And this leading figure is, so to speak, the model of a highly motivated worker who does it all for the good of his collective, but doesn't care much about socialism. And so a big drama revolves around his person, whether he cannot be won over for socialism, and this drama is taking the way, so to speak, of a love story with a female engineer, construction engineer, which happens to be married, which was a big scandal at the time still, which because adultery still of party members would still involve party action. We are here in the late 50s where the story is set. So this is a love drama set in the heroic times of early times of construction of socialism. What makes it so made it so popular was, first of all, Manfred Krug himself, who was a very popular actor, still alive. I think, he's now in his 70s. Who has an extremely sympathetic way to render such an open-minded, unconventional, honest worker, very strong physical presence, and against which all these party functionaries and intellectuals and so on look a little bit odd and poor guys, so to speak. So it's this also this gender, this male sexuality aspect, which carries the film very far. And by the way in which, in particular in the opening scenes of the film, by the way in which this brigade of workers behave, they show a kind of alternative working class style in the heroic early times of the GDR, where workers still really believed in their own mission to achieve as much as they can, and also taking and using means and methods which were not exactly legal or proper, but they're practical. And the story being told in the middle of the 60s, you see a kind of feeling that meanwhile, of course, construction of socialism has become a rather dull and bureaucratic enterprise against which one sets this utopia, so to speak, of an authentic worker spirit. The movie was extremely successful when it was shown for 2 weeks in 1966, but already in summer 1966, already the weeks and months before that, an internal party internal campaign had been raised and organized against it. So interestingly enough, since it was so much on real workers, the management of the DEFA had thought it could kind of come away with it after in December 65 all these other films had already been banned. So they thought that if they present this film now, the party leadership will be reconciled and keep quiet, because now they finally have their film with a real good and nice worker. And they were also relying on this speculation, because after all the film was based on a novel which had been 10 years old already by that time, which was a very conventional construction of socialist novel, which was very popular also with the party leadership. So they thought, the DEFA management thought, to be on the safe side, but had not considered that as one part of the story. The first section of the film entailed that a policeman, a representative of state authority, was abused by being thrown into a water pond by these workers, and that there was a lot of irony and joking and, so to speak, joking also about authorities entailed in this movie, and this was going beyond the limit. And after 2 weeks being on show, the SED and the party staged riots, so to speak, or unrest in the cinema theaters with people protesting. You can organize it. And then, of course, the party could say, we have to withdraw the film. It stirs up so much unrest. And it was put on the shelf for the remaining time of the GDR and was premiered again in 1989. And since then, as I told you, is the most popular feature film of the GDR. The director of the film, and this is why I mentioned it so at length, the director of the film is Frank Beyer. Frank Beyer is the director which we will deal more at length with the next time. Frank Beyer also was hit by the ban on Spur der Steine, on this other film, this one. After 1966, after he had finished Spur der Steine, he could not do a feature film again for 10 years. He was kind of removed to television to do documentaries. This was also seems to be the punishment, so to speak, if one of these directors went too far with something. And only in 1974 to 75, he was allowed to work on the next feature film, Jakob der Lügner, Jacob the Liar. And I'm now giving you some information on this film right now, although it belongs already to the next section in 2 weeks, because as I was told, the screening of the film will already be next Wednesday. So I give you some information in advance right now. Jakob der Lügner is a story set in a, not specified, in a ghetto in occupied Poland, a Jewish ghetto in occupied Poland under Nazi occupation, approximately in the beginning of the 40s. It is based on a seminal novel, one of the most important novels of East German authors, on the Holocaust and the persecution of the Jews under Nazism, by Jurek Becker. Jurek Becker, coming himself from a Jewish family which had left Poland in order to settle down in East Germany in 45 already, together with his father, was a high-profile author and had written this story. I will give you more details next time, and published it in 68. What is new and, so to speak, rather specific in the context of GDR history dealing with the Nazi past, about which I will talk more extensively next time, but in order to prepare you a little bit, what is unique is that it uses comical elements, irony, jokes as a way and as a part to describe the situation in the ghetto in order to develop the plot. And this also not only in the context of GDR film history, but of course also in the context of international history of films dealing with the Holocaust, was at that time rather unique. Nowadays, if we associate the question how to represent the Holocaust with means of comedy and so on, the first things we come to our mind is Benigni's Life is Beautiful and this the train, how is it called, with a train story also set as a comedy. I don't remember the precise name, but these are much more recent films of the 90s. Already then, Frank Beyer tried this adaptation of the novel Jakob der Lügner, tried to integrate comical elements in describing, so to speak, the horrors and the fate of the persecuted Jews in Poland. The idea is very simple. And Jurek Becker claims that he has got the idea from a story of a survivor. By chance, a man living in the Jakob, living in the ghetto, overhears some snips of radio transmission from the German radio, from which he can conclude that the Russians are relatively near to the ghetto, not that far away as the ghetto inhabitants had thought, and he spreads the news and then pretends, since he is asked again, then pretends that he has a radio. This is why the story is called The Liar. He is lying that he would have a radio and invents stories after stories in order to maintain and uplift the morale of the co-inhabitants of the ghetto. And so the interplay of truth and lie and will to survive, and the will to survive as also an aspect of resistance, but resistance of another way than the traditional heroic anti-fascist struggle sort of resistance. This is the central theme around which this story revolves, and which was received at that time as quite a novelty. A novelty insofar as within the context of East German film history, the representation of the Holocaust, of course, had to stick to some dogmatic hierarchy of important central figures, in which, so to speak, the normal life of such a space as the ghetto did not feature very much, or did not have a particular importance. So it is, so to speak, remarkable in this regard, this film. And it's remarkable also for another reason, which has to do also with the country I'm teaching here now. It is a GDR Czechoslovakian co-production. So you see, I don't know whether I pronounce it right, Lastimil Brodsky. So how?
Yes, you are pronouncing it.
And which is the leading male part, the Jakob, the liar. And it features Erwin Goschenik, which is one of a part, together with Manfred Krug, one can say one of the prototype of male proletarian worker character in the East German cinema. He's a little bit older than Manfred Krug. He's, I think he died last year or so in the age of 90, and has played in quite a lot of 50 films, something like that, always representing the upright, open-minded, frank, working-class hero. And it features also the only world star of East German cinema, Armin Müller-Stahl, when he was still a bit younger. That's so far for today, with an such big outlook for next week, because you are going to see this film already by next week. What we are going to in the next session or double session is then have a look in general at the way in which DEFA cinema treated the Nazi period, not just with regard to the Holocaust, but also with regard to other aspects of the history of the Second World War. In that context, I will also come back to some of the films of Konrad Wolf, because he has also heavily contributed to this agenda. And then I will present you, introduce you into the oeuvre of Frank Baier, for whom dealing with the history of the Third Reich and of the Nazi crimes has always been a very central topic of his art. This was not the only film, but one can say Jakob the Liar in that sense was the most successful of Frank Baier's films, because it was, after all, the only GDR film that at least made it to a candidate for an Oscar award in Hollywood, a candidate as Oscar award for the best foreign film in 1976, when I remember right. And so it therefore merits also some attention, as I think. Okay, thank you very much for today.